Everybody, I'm Karen. I'm alcoholic. I am standing up. Well, thank you, Phil, for asking me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope with you all. It's a lovely ride down. I didn't have to drive, so it was great. So, and you know, it's an honor and a privilege, you know, to be asked to speak at an AA meeting. It's an honor and privilege to be asked to go anywhere, really. When I was drinking, most people were not saying, keep coming back. They were like, please don't ever come back. we never want to see you again, kind of comments. And rightly so. You know, I was not a nice girl who drank too much. Although I'd like to think that at times. I grew up in a nice middle-class family and lived in a nice suburban home outside of Washington, D.C. And although this is pretty funny, the street that I grew up on was obviously like a little breeding ground for alcoholics, because the first meeting I went to, my first sponsor was somebody who grew up with me. She lived down the street from me. And she was one of those people, and I think I know for many alcoholics, she was one of those people that I always set aside as like, I'm not as bad as her. You know, she would have blackouts and wake up in other states. You know, I would just wake up, you know, in the front lawn. And so she took me to my first meeting, and there was a young man there who was actually sober longer than I, but he remembered that I used to babysit him. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, what a role model I must have been. You know, the street that I grew up on was a little, it was a cul-de-sac. It was a dead end. It was, you know, Honesty Way. So I think about that. Honesty Way was a dead end. And when it came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they, you know, told us we had to be rigorously honest. I always just thought that was kind of ironic or funny. But anyway, I come from a long line of alcoholics. I have lots of alcoholism on both sides of my family. And what's important about that is that I just assumed as a child that that's what adults did. I mean, my parents drank a lot, all of their friends drank a lot, all of our relatives drank a lot. I just figured that's kind of whatever, you know, when you get to be an adult, that's what you do, you drink a lot. And they would be funny sometimes, and sometimes it would not be very funny. You know, it would be scary and crazy and loud, and stuff would get broken, and, you know, people would get in horrible arguments. But for the most part, it looked very, very interesting. And I was fascinated at an early age, you know, with alcohol. And, you know, I did not notice at the time when I was growing up, and I don't think anyone in our family really, you know, said this, but, you know, in hindsight, I realized that my father was an alcoholic. He actually died of liver failure when I was in my 20s, but no one ever said alcoholic. You know, no one ever said, you know, because my father made six figures, was a lobbyist, we lived in a nice middle-class neighborhood in a nice, you know, split-level house and went to good schools, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, that's not, you know, alcoholics didn't look like, you know, nice Republican people kind of thing. And but, you know, I had that intuition, you know, as, you know, sort of, you know, going into, you know, as an adolescent and kind of going into junior high school and stuff, because, you know, the disease was progressing in my family. And, of course, I didn't realize that, but I just knew that stuff at home was getting more and more turbulent and more, you know, problematic. And the fights were getting louder and worse and scarier. And I intuitively had a thought that it was like, well, it was related to the drinking that my parents were doing. And I remember, of course, you know, I will certainly date myself at this point, you know, this is, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, you know, so there was a lot of interesting things going on, and especially in Washington, D.C., a lot of really interesting things going on, and, you know, and I was like, squared it all off, you know, and I was a good kid, you know, I was a Girl Scout and safety patrol and made good grades, and, you know, I was the kid that, you know, would hang out, you know, with the neighborhood kids causing trouble. That would kind of be like the cover, like, that, you know, stuff wasn't going wrong because, oh, Karen's with you guys, obviously you're not getting into trouble, you know, and at that point, not so much. Eventually, we all were, I, you know, still was the cover, and so I was leading a double life at an early age, you know, and And I think about that because I think about making that, you know, that promise to myself, you know, at like 13, it's like, I will never drink, you know, I'll never do drugs, I'll never smoke cigarettes, I'll never drink, it's bad, you know, it's bad for you, you know, and I did all of those things, you know, and I became an alcoholic, you know, and I just, that, you know, that is a reminder of my powerlessness, you know, that even though I knew then that it was dangerous, it was unhealthy, you know, but that didn't stop me. You know, when the opportunity came, it didn't stop me. And, you know, eventually I became more, you know, irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, I don't know if it was, you know, part of, you know, adolescence or just part of, you know, the progression of my alcoholism, you know, sort of internally, but I became more and more, you know, anxious and ill at ease, and I remember I had this feeling growing up that I just, you know, was like the outsider looking, and I hear that so often at meetings, you know, and I felt like everyone, you know, like I missed that day at school, like everyone knew what to do and had the homework and had it down, and I just like kind of got, you know, I didn't get that, you know, chapter in my book of life or something, and so I just always felt, you know, not quite fitting, not quite belonging, not quite sure what to do, and I would, you know, I had many, many acquaintances growing up, you know, like I said, I was the kind of, you know, geeky kids that the cool kids, you know, hung out with as, you know, kind of the cover, and you know, and I, you know, the smart kids and the, you know, all of them, you know, I knew them all, but I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. I really felt like I was, you know, kind of a chameleon, and I could try to be what you wanted me to be in that moment to fit in. And that was exhausting. You know, I mean, it was really hard just to try to do what I thought everyone wanted me to do, everyone else's, you know, expectations of me. And certainly I couldn't be myself because I knew, you know, that was not okay. It was not okay to be me, you know. And then I found alcohol, you know, and the heavens parted, and I came to heaven, you know, and it was like, oh, you know. And I hear that so often, you know, at meetings, you know, where, you know, it's not so much what alcohol did to me, but it's what alcohol did for me, you know, where I drank, and suddenly, you know, miraculously, you know, I wasn't so worried about what people thought. In fact, I was sure I fit. In fact, I was sure I was the life of the party. I was sure that I was now the coolest person in the room. And I did not care, you know, what you all thought of me. And I didn't, you know, and I could relax. I felt like I could breathe. I could finally breathe. I was no longer sort of worried about, you know, was I doing things right. I didn't worry anymore. And it was wonderful. And I, you know, and I really took off with that. And I was a blackout drinker from early on. I did not realize, and probably until I was, I don't know, in my 20s, that most people did not black out when they drank. I figured everybody was blacking out when they drank. And I figured it was just a kind of a combination of beverages and how much I ate and what I ate and the time of day and, you know, and the alignment of the planets or whatever. But there was some kind of formula of, you know, combination, and I did enhancers, you know, of you know, alcohol and other chemicals that I could take that I would be in that great euphoria, that great oblivion where I really didn't care what you thought or what I thought. You know, I was, you know, happy. I was free, and I would, you know, not black out, you know, not pass out. And I actually, you know, I really was not, I wasn't much of a pass out, you know, get sick kind of drunk. I was kind of a blackout drunk, so I was doing all kinds of mischief, you know, long into the evening that I did not recall, you know. I remember the first time that I realized that had happened, and I was in college. I went to school, you know. This is pretty crazy. I was determined to get away from my family. At this point, you know, when I graduated from high school, things were very, very crazy in my home, you know. And you know, the truth was, you know, we talked about, you know, it was a dysfunctional family. I mean, part of the reason it was dysfunctional is because I was there. I mean, I was part of the active alcoholism that was going on in my family at that time. Of course, I didn't realize it, but, you know, I wanted to just get as far away from my family as possible. I was going to go to California because I think everybody in, you know, the 70s wanted to go to California. And my parents were having none of it, you know. So I made the mistake of thinking if I went to college in the Midwest, I would be like halfway to California. And that really didn't work out, you know. And there again, you know, this great alcoholic thinking, you know. It's like, yeah, I'll be halfway there, you know, in Ohio. You know, and so I was going to school in Southern Ohio, very conservative, you know, good college, very conservative town. You know, very conservative college town. It was dry. They sold 3-2 beer. I had no understanding of that. It's like watered down beer. And I'm like, why? Why would you bother? And I started to get kicked out of bars for bringing alcohol in to the bar. And I just thought that wasn't right, you know, because it's like, what's the point of being in a bar, you know, if you can't really drink? And anyway, I went off to school, and lost my train of thought. And I really majored in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I did not attend classes. I was not very diligent a student. Oh, I started to realize I was blacking out because I would go to these parties, and then I would run into people on campus the next day, and they would be like, they would know my name, and I'm like, okay, well, that's not so bad. And then they would proceed to tell me whole conversations and activities that we had done. It was not just some kind of casual conversation, you know. It was like, you know, we took a trip somewhere or something, and I'm like, wow, you know. And I remember that sense of that flood of panic that first happens. It's like, oh, my God, I don't know what happened. And then it was like, oh, well. And I realized, you know, and I became actually very good at a kind of, you know, misdirection and sort of detecting, you know, to sort of, you know, get information out of people so I sort of can kind of reconstruct the evening so I could pretend like I knew what had happened even though I had no idea. And and eventually, you know, there again, I that was too much work, you know, to try to piece it all together, and I couldn't be bothered, you know. And but consequently, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll was not a recognized major at this college, and so they asked me to leave. And that was, you know, the beginning of being asked to leave, you know, many prestigious, fine universities, you know, fine institutions. And I started on a pattern of moving back home, you know, working. Okay, if I get a job, get, you know, focus, you know, have some kind of direction and discipline in my life, you know, that would be good. And I would work for a while. And, of course, you know, I'd always been a good student. So my parents were like, you know, you need to reach your potential. Oh, my God, the potential talks. You know, there was always a talk about, Karen, you have such potential, you know, what are you doing? And you're like, And I would go back to school, and I would do okay for a semester. And my transcript was crazy. I mean, I would have, like, an A, you know, a B, an incomplete, a WF, and an F, you know, kind of a thing. And my parents would be like, what is this? You know, obviously you could do something because here you have, you know, A on one side of things and F on the other. And I'd be like, well, you know, that class was like 8:00 in the morning. You know, and I was like, I don't know what possessed me to register for that class. And of course, I could never get around to like dropping it in time, you know, before grades would come in. And eventually, you know, I was on, you know, academic dismissal or whatever. And did move back home for a long time, and did start working, and I started to work for this small savings and loan in the area, and actually did very well. And that was one of the things that for me in my drinking career, you know, I was able to hold certain things together that would be, well, I can't be alcoholic because, And for me, it was work. I was always able to work, to show up at work. I would often be impaired. I would often go out at lunchtime, you know, for medicinal reasons, and yet somehow be able to keep it together. And it was not until actually it wasn't until I got sober that I realized that I did lose a job because of my drinking. But at the time, no one said that to me. You know, no one ever said, you know, we want you to resign because we're worried about, you know, about what's going on with you. And at that point, you know, my performance, people just knew I was off because they knew I had such potential. But I was able to work, and I was always able to keep a job and be promoted and sort of, you know, have that illusion of having it together. And working and living at home was great because my parents charged me like nominal rent. And so now I had, you know, tons of disposable income that, of course, I disposed of on booze. And I in Washington, I don't know if people are familiar, there's 355, which is a road that goes into Georgetown, Wisconsin Avenue, and it actually goes all the way out to Frederick. Of course, I didn't. And there was all kinds of, you know, bars along 355. And I did the cruising. I would either start downtown and work my way out, or start out and work my way down. And I knew, like, all the ladies' nights and all the half price, you know, happy hours and all that kind of stuff along, you know, the route there. And I would be a regular at a bar and would go there for a while, and then there would be some kind of incident, and I would no longer go back. And generally, it involved, you know, someone's boyfriend, husband, something like that, you know, and some inappropriate behavior, and I just would often not really remember what had happened, and that's kind of the truth, and so that never played well. It's like, I did what? You know, what are you talking about? And and eventually, you know, I can't say that I had a lot of consequences. Outside consequences, knock on wood, I never was arrested for DWI. That does not mean that I didn't drive drunk. And in fact, I had an accident drunk, and I'm not quite sure what happened. I'm pretty sure I hit, like, I was in an underground garage, and I hit, you know, cement, you know, piling there, you know, but I don't really know what happened. And I got home, and the whole, you know, front fender was, you know, smashed in, and I had no idea what had happened. And instead of, you know, there again, instead of thinking that, wow, this is kind of messed up, I was just like, I really need to be careful when I'm drinking and driving. And if I'm too drunk to drive, I would just leave my car where it was. And often I would not remember where it was. And that became an interesting little game the next day to be like, okay, where's Karen's car? And amazingly, I would find it, you know, but it was a little game. But that's kind of how I looked at it, you know. I would have that moment of a panic and, oh my God, this is kind of crazy. And then would be quickly, you know, suppressed and supplanted by, you know, let me figure out a way to get out of it. It's not that bad. You know, it's not this and this. You know, I didn't kill anybody, or I didn't get caught, or what. You know, I did find my, you know, wasn't towed away. I found it. You know, it was fine, and we all laughed about it. And that's how I went. I was able to sort of rationalize and justify, you know, all that I was doing. And since there wasn't, you know, those really strong outside consequences, you know, legal, that sort of thing. But there was that slow deterioration on the inside, you know, and that just that sort of nagging feeling like this is not okay. You know, it's funny. Sometimes it was very funny. It was comical, you know, whatever. It was, you know, fun. But there was something that was just not right, and I felt like, you know, eventually, you know, my sisters, I have three sisters, and they were getting married and graduated from college and sort of, you know, getting their lives together, and I'm still sort of living at home, you know, hitting the happy hours and those sort of things, and not really having any kind of direction or goals for my life or any of that kind of thing, and not really caring about that. There again, not even in worried about that sort of stuff. But I did start to worry about things like, you know, I shouldn't be driving drunk, and I would leave my car, you know, at home. And then, you know, I would go to a bar, and usually I would be, you know, kind of, you know, I was kind of an obnoxious drunk, and I was generally pretty happy. I wasn't too, you know, depressive, thank goodness. That kind of came at the end. But at the beginning there, I was pretty wild and crazy, and often, you know, I would, like I said, I would, you know, blackout drink, or I would wake up in various states of undress, not sure if things were coming off or going back on, you know. I would just, you know, I wasn't quite sure what had happened, you know, and, a friend of mine recently, actually, she lived with me for a while and was very involved in getting me sober. I saw her at a party yesterday, and we were talking, and she was reminding, we had worked together, and she was reminding we had gone out to hear this local band play, and we had left our cars where we had worked, and we both had passed out in our cars, like in front of work, from the night before, and woke up like at the same time, and then like went to work, you know, pretty much wearing the same clothes that we had worn the night before, you know, and it was just sort of like, aha, you know, how convenient, we passed out in front of work, all right, you know, how good was that timing, you know, and I mean, that's how I sort of thought about things. It's like, oh, how fortuitous, you know, passed out in front of work, okay, good, and, but, you know, the bars and you know, going out and doing stuff became harder and harder to do that, and you know, I became more worried, and I would be with people that I didn't want to be with, and I would be in situations that I knew I didn't want to be in, and you know, after I was there, you know, kind of, and I was like, okay, how did I get there? And I wouldn't know what would happen, and so it's like, you know, my world started to compress. And I think that that's really very true for a lot of us, that alcohol, you know, that alcohol prison starts to close everything in, and I you know, can't go out to bars because I'm not sure what's going to happen when I start drinking and where I'm going to end up or who I'm going to end up with. And, you know, I my friends, you know, my peers are sort of, you know, getting on a career track, and so I'm hanging out with, you know, either younger people or way older people than me, you know, that are sort of also kind of in that kind of lifestyle of you know, restlessness and, you know, kind of aimlessness partying, you know, and when it's, you know, fun to be a party animal when you're 19, it's not so cool when you're 27. And my world started getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And, ironically, a friend of our family, decided to run for public office and actually won. And, you know, and I worked on her campaign, and political campaigns are great opportunities to party, at least they were, you know, 20-some years ago, and so I worked on I worked on her campaign, and it never occurred to me that she would actually win and offer me a job, and there again, you know, alcoholic planning, you know, it's like, what? I could actually work for you? Okay, you know, and I went to work on Capitol Hill, and at that time, you know, in the mid-80s, it was still pretty lively, and it was a great place to be an alcoholic because there were receptions pretty much every night, and I would go to represent my boss, and I would go up to the bar and get two drinks, you know, presumably one for me and one for my boss, you know, and of course she really didn't drink much at these events, you know, so I could, you know, do lots of you know, free drinking and free, you know, boozing and schmoozing, and I, you know, and what a great, you know, opportunity for my, you know, grandiosity, you know, here I am hobnobbing, you know, Capitol Hill, you know, wheelers and dealers and stuff, and really it was it was very exciting and very chaotic and pretty stressful. And so often a lot of people were drinking very heavily, and it was a bit of a culture, you know, there and stuff. But there again, you know, it was I became concerned about what was going to, you know, happen. And I can't believe I didn't get fired when this happened, but my boss had gone out of town, and I had her car that had, like, the congressional plates on it, because I was going to pick her up at the airport the next morning and then take her to all these speaking engagements. And I went to a bunch of receptions for her, and one at the Kennedy Center, which was, I mean, these really nice parties and stuff. And I just got really hammered, and I'm not quite sure how I got home. And in her car, I'm driving drunk in her car, and I parked it at my apartment in the fire lane. And so when I got up the next day to go get her, the car had been towed. And so I was like an hour late picking her up from the airport, and she may have actually taken a cab. Actually, I may have even missed her completely at the airport. I think that's what happened. I mean, I was still drunk. And she was speaking at this elementary school, and I had to get up and be sick, and I went back into the bathroom, and it's the little kids' bathrooms, you know, and the toilet was like, you know, like 6 inches off the ground, you know, and I am practically like lying down in the bathroom, and there's no doors on the, you know, because it's for the kindergarten, you got to be able to walk, you know, so I'm like lying down, you know, and she comes in and she's like, "Are you all right?" I'm like, "I'm fine." She knew I was not fine, and it was not good, and I think about it this time of year with the springtime, you know, my little sister got married at the end of April, and I barely remember that event. I mean, I was in the wedding and stuff like that, and I must have been a mess. I mean, I really barely remember what happened, and obviously she was horrified because I think on her honeymoon she started planning an intervention for me because just because you're paranoid does not mean that people are not plotting against you, kind of thing. She and my roommate started to conspire to get me some help, and that became probably one of the precedents, you know, for me in my recovery, in my sobriety, is that other people have been at times more invested in my well-being than I have been, you know, and so they started, they were me, you know, I didn't know what was going on. They knew I was getting ready. And interestingly enough, I was reminded of a story recently with someone woman was sharing. I'm working up on the hill, and we would often have, you know, the television on. Either it would be on the house floor, or it would be on, you know, CNN, and it was, you know, on CNN. And they were doing this whole thing. It was Kitty Dukakis, and she had, you know, drank the rubbing alcohol and was hospitalized and all this kind of stuff, and so there all this commentation, you know, what's going on, and alcohol, we don't understand this, you know, and this kind of thing, and I hear this voice, I can't really see the TV, but I hear this voice, and it's my neighbor that I grew up with. She's working for the National Council on Alcoholism. She's not there as a member of AA, but she's there as someone talking about alcoholism, and I'm like, oh my God, this voice, you know, you know, this disembodied voice, like, talking about alcoholism. I'm like, I know this voice, you know, and I had reached out to her, and she took me to a couple meetings, and I was like, you know, they want me to stop drinking, you know, it took about 3 or 4 meetings for me to catch on to that part of it, you know. It's like, these people don't want me to drink, you know, and I'm like, I'm not ready for that. But, you know, I had made the mistake of sort of mentioning to my sister that, you know, I'd seen this old neighbor of ours, and so they really started the conspiracy, and they orchestrated a little intervention on me, and, you know, I'm horrified that there is actually a television show that's about interventions now. I cannot imagine, like, I would not have wanted that televised, you know. And, you know, actually, I'm really grateful that, so, like, YouTube did not, you know, the internet was not in existence, girls gone wild, you know, all that kind of stuff, because I would have been all over the internet, you know. And, so I really felt like I really kind of dodged a bullet on a couple of those things. And, but they got me over to my roommate's mother's house, you know, on the guise of some kind of brunch, you know, luncheon kind of a thing. And I walk in, and it's my sister and this friend, you know, a neighbor, and a cousin, and some other people, and someone I did not recognize, and they're all sitting in, like, this semicircle, you know, and I walk down the stairs, and they all look up at me, you know, with that look, you know, and we all know the look, and I'm like, God, I hope there's somebody behind me, kind of a thing, and they all are like, Karen, you know, we want to talk to you about you, you know, and I'm like, oh no. And they start to tell, you know, they have their script, they're telling me stories about various times when they've, you know, were disturbed by my drinking, you know, by my behavior, and they're kind of going through this stuff. And I remember having two thoughts. I was shocked that they were sort of, that they had been affected by my behavior. And for me, you know, the alienation and the isolation of alcoholism, I had no sense. I mean, that self-centeredness, just that imprisonment of alcohol, I could not imagine that my behavior was impacting other people. I was just quietly drinking myself over there in the corner, you know, going to work, coming home, that was pretty much it. I was going to work, coming home, leading that vampire lifestyle, barely going out in the light of day. My apartment complex had a convenience store, and I could get beer and wine in the basement. I didn't even have to get dressed and go out. I could go downstairs in my bathrobe and get beer and wine. I mean, I was really not interacting with a lot of people at the end there. And I was stunned that these people had kind of, like, they noticed. And not only had they noticed, that they were upset, that they were worried. And quickly on the heels of that was, oh my God, they don't even know the half of it. This is like the tip of the iceberg, this kind of stuff. You know, this is, they don't even know about the stuff that I think is screwed up. You know, and they're worried about this stuff. It's like, please, you know. And I had that moment, you know, it talks about, you know, we get to those crossroads, we have those moments, and I had that moment of like, okay. I'll go, you know. And they had packed my bags and had made arrangements for work, and I was going to go off to treatment for 30 days. Now, about 3 days into it, I was sure that they had made a horrible mistake. Those people were really sick, you know. I had a job on Capitol Hill, you know, and this kind of stuff. And these people, like, were messed up. And, but, you know, there I was. And I remember the tremendous relief when I sort of got it, when I really kind of, when I surrendered, when I got that my problem wasn't that I was crazy or not good enough or didn't fit in or didn't know what everybody else knew, that my problem was that I was alcoholic. And when I, and it was a tremendous, like, it was like, aha, you know, there again, you know, the clouds parted, the light came, you know, it was like, oh, that's it. That's what's been going on all this time. You know, and prior to that, my father had died, and I knew I was very much like him, you know, and I think one of the counselors there said, well, you know, some, you know, will die so others can live. And I thought that was such a screwed up thing to say to somebody. But I kind of got it, because I realized that I was like my dad. Of all of my siblings, and in my family, our personalities were the most similar. And we got, and I saw that, and I realized it's like, you know, he was a functioning, you know, alcoholic, whatever. But I realized, you know, that I was probably going to have his destiny if I didn't do something different. And I was so relieved that the problem was that I was an alcoholic, and I was so terrified at the same moment, because everything I did, where I lived, had a convenience store, you know, in the basement. I mean, everything, everyone I associated with, everything I did was all centered around alcohol. You know, I'd never, before I'd gotten sober, I'd never gone to like a Denny's or, you know, a Big Boy. What was the point? They didn't serve alcohol there. You know, I was like, you know, I didn't know. And I was not sure how I was going to live sober. And I'm very grateful that the treatment center that I was in, and that was just my experience. You don't have to go to treatment to get sober, but that's just what happened to me. They were very, that meetings were brought into us. We went out to meetings. They were very, I got a big book and a 12 and 12 when I was there, and they were like, this is just sort of like getting you off the merry-go-round. And, you know, they told me I had a progressive fatal disease that would need lifelong, medicine, and that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to be, you know, that treatment for me, you know, that ongoing treatment, and that I should get in the middle of it. You know, you can't fall off the bed if you're, you know, lying in the middle kind of a thing, and to get a sponsor and to get real involved. And I did. You know, and I don't know where that willingness came from, you know, other than grace. I asked the woman that I grew up with to be my first sponsor, and which was convenient because she, you know, knew a lot of my story and had been in some of adventures in some of my story. And you know, we, God love her. I mean, I would call her, like five times, six times a day. And I would be like, you know, I call her up and I'm like, I'm so nervous, I'm so anxious and stuff like that. And she's like, did you eat anything today? And I would be like, does coffee count? And she'd be like, no, eat something. And I'm like, okay. You know, and I hang up and I eat something. And I'd call her back like, you know, half an hour later. I'm like, okay, now what do I do? And she's like, are you at work? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, why don't you do some work? And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I mean, I really did not know what to do with myself. And I call her up and I'm like, you know, and of course lunch hour, you know, I went out and I would, you know, go out and drink and stuff. And I said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do at lunchtime. You know, I'm so used to going out and drinking and stuff. And she's like, I bet you that there are some meetings on Capitol Hill at lunchtime. And I'm like, do you think? You know? And sure enough, there was. And there was one in the Library of Congress that became a home group for me that I went to religiously for years and years. And it was a wonderful group. And I was there was a bunch of old-timer guys. And I was the crazy girl newcomer that was really good for a lot of entertainment value, I think, in that meeting. And they were so patient with me because I would just come in there and just be like, ah! And they, you know, they never told me, you know, to sit down and shut up, you know. But they did tell me to keep coming back. and then maybe I should talk to my sponsor about some of that stuff. And then eventually, you know, my first sponsor, God love her, had the nerve to get married and like move away. And I was like, how could she, you know, to me. And I needed to get another sponsor, and I got so crazy. I was so foggy that first year. I mean, I barely remember, and I think I cried at pretty much every meeting I went to, and I went to tons of meetings, you know, pretty much two a day there, and I loved the meetings. I don't remember half the time what people were talking about, but I felt safe there, and I knew I was safe there, and I didn't get it. Like, why? They hang out in church basements in those days. They were smoking meetings, and I didn't smoke, and I think that was one of my first resentments in AA. It's like, I hate these smoking meetings, and I don't smoke, you know. I'm one of the few people that I know that did not, that quit smoking while they were drinking. I don't know how that happened, but, well, I do know how that happened, but, but But I would go, and I felt safe, you know. And I came to believe, you know, I came to believe in my sponsor. My sponsor was my first higher power, and I would do what she would say, and I would feel better. And a lot of times I didn't understand it, and I didn't really like it. And I, you know, I'm 31 years old, and I felt pretty juvenile, kind of pouting, you know. That's the director. She's like, no, you can't go to that cake party, you know. And I'm like, oh, but you know. It's my cousin, you know, and she's like, is there AA people going to be? She's like, if you can get some people from AA to go with you, you can go. Well, of course she knew no one from AA was going to go with me to a kegger. And so I was just like, oh. But I did what she said, and I felt better. And then, you know, and I came to believe in the meetings. Like I said, I would go to the meetings, and I would feel better. And just for that hour, I would be okay. I wouldn't be bouncing off the walls. I knew I wouldn't drink, you know, at the meeting. I haven't yet to be at an AA meeting when they actually serve alcohol there. And so I felt pretty safe, you know, being in the meeting. And I came to believe in a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that there had been millions of people that had gotten sober in AA. And I thought, well, if they could get sober, this could happen to me. You know, why couldn't that happen to me? And I loved the people with lots of mayhem and destruction and, you know, really, really crazy stories. You know, I was completely enthralled with that, you know, because I just felt like my story was sort of, you know, white bread kind of thing. And, yeah, drank a lot in suburbia, you know, wow. fast times in Bethesda kind of a thing. But, you know, it was just, the mean streets of, you know, Chevy Chase kind of a thing. But, I believed them. I believed that, you know, I believed that people had been through this stuff. And I related so much to how people felt when they were drinking and how they felt about themselves, that sense of not belonging and not fitting in and feeling like, you know, other people were better than, and I related so much to that. And then I also related to how they felt about their sobriety and how they were coping and the kinds of things that pissed them off and getting resentful at traffic. I mean, I would go into my noon meeting and, talk about, you know, it would be like a five-finger day, and it would be like, and it's like, that's the many time I flipped people off on the way to work, you know. And that was kind of my first sort of gauge of my spiritual progress, you know. When I did not give everyone the bird, you know, when I drove into work, that I was like, I have progressed. I'm spiritually evolved now. And, you know, eventually, you know, I said my sponsor moved away, and I needed a new sponsor. I needed to do a four step. And this woman, I would see her at this Friday night meeting, and there again, she would share, and I can't even remember half the things that she would talk about, but she was always really nice to me, you know, and would give me a hug, and she would be like, keep coming back, it's going to get better, and all this kind of stuff like that. And I just went up to her and asked her, you know, I said, I need to do a four-step, will you be my sponsor? She was like, sure, you know. And there again, I really felt like that was kind of another grace in my life, because I really knew nothing of her story. I didn't know hardly anything about her, you know. But I knew I was drawn to her, and, you know, she's still my sponsor today, you know. She moved away, but I kept her as a sponsor, and I actually just went up to see her recently, this past week, and it was great. And we, you know, work steps, and she... She has some people stay in her house, some new people, a young couple, and we were talking to them about doing their four step, and she was cracking up. She's like, she goes, it was hilarious. You had the state of Ohio, you know, on your four step as a resentment, you know. And I'm like, yeah, that damn state, you know. And they're like, first it seduced me to thinking I was gonna get to California from there, you know, and then that crazy, you know, 3-2 beer thing, and just a lot of really, really crazy stuff happened to me there, you know, in terms, and it was my drinking, but that's how we are, you know. It's not me, it's, you know, it's other people, it's them, you know. In other words, it's this place, you know, this is why my life was so screwed up, it was this state, you know, and it's got, you know, the same, you know, first letter, and is the same as the last letter, that's not right, you know, and whatever, but she reminded me of that, you know, how they were all cracking up, and I said, well, you know, you're supposed to write down, you know, ideas and institutions that you have resentments against, so there it was, the state of Ohio, and, you know, ironically, when I got to the place where I needed to make amends, you know, I hadn't gone back there, and I had a couple of really good friends from my college days there, and one of my girlfriends, who actually graduated from the college where we all met, was an actual alumni from that institution, shortly after I did my eighth step and went over with my sponsor and was looking at ninth step, you know, I had stuff. I stole from the university. I was a terrible student. That was the first place that I was ever confronted on my behavior outwardly. The person that was in charge of the dorm confronted me. I mean, she busted me for smoking pot, you know, in my room one day. She came in, she's like, Karen, I think you might have, you know, an alcohol and drug problem. And I think I actually said, like, F you, you know. to her, you know, that was pretty much my response, you know, that's pretty much my response to everybody in those days, you know, but, you know, I don't even know if I had turned 18 yet, you know, or if I was, you know, 18 years old, and they were like, you know, Karen, I think you have an alcohol problem, and I was just like, that can't be, you know, I'm too young, and I did, and I think about that in the big book, where, and even in the 12 and 12 where it talks about, you know, we look back over our drinking history and there were times early on where there were sort of those warning signals, you know. At 18, I was a blackout drinker, you know. I was flunking. I was already having consequences. I was flunking out of college that, I was smart enough to do well. I just never did anything. So it's like, you know, being confronted, you know, my behavior, I don't know, this is like the fall. I've been living there like 3 months on campus, and I'm already like getting busted out, you know? But I didn't, that's what you do when you're in college. And, you know, I had to drink another, you know, 12, 13 years before I was like, oh, maybe I am. And when I was at that point, that moment of surrender, those crossroads, that, you know, her voice came back to me, those professors, you know, that kind of said, Karen, you know, what's up with your grades, like you're, you know, you're passed out in the class. You know, I know you could do better than this, that potential thing. You know, all those voices came back to me, you know, saying, you know, that maybe you have a problem here. And that's kind of when the puzzle came all together. But ironically, I had to go back to Ohio, you know, to like make a, you know, kind of that pretender song, you know. Go back to Ohio, and I had to make amends, and I made amends to the dean in the school who like met with me and my parents to kind of help me so I wouldn't be on academic probation. I didn't say F you to him, but I, you know, I did say, you know, and I saw the woman who had been in charge of the dorm. And was able to make a you know, amends to them, and I feel comfortable, you know, going in and out of Ohio these days. Although I don't have much occasion to do so, but you know, I'd be okay with that. And so many, you know, sobriety has been you know, one of the things that I think if you're new in recovery and sobriety and people talk about, you know, I come to AA and, you know, my life is great. Yay! And you know, my life is life. And you know, what's different is me and my ability to sort of cope with life. I've had many wonderful things happen. I met my husband. We were kidding around, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus. You know, I met my husband in the rooms, and we went to a young people's conference, actually, in Hawaii, and got married on the beach at sunset in Hawaii. It was so freaking Hollywood, you know. I was like, oh, my God, you know. I mean, it was gorgeous. gorgeous. And it was just like, this cannot possibly be my life, you know. And it was wonderful. And you know, so many of our friends were there, and my stepson. And it was just great. And you know, and then we had, you know, hard times, you know. I've lost loved ones, you know, to natural causes and unnatural causes like alcoholism. And you know, I've watched people come in and out of the rooms, people that I love and care about, and you know, die alcoholic deaths, which is horrible, you know. And I've had my own internal sort of demons, you know, trying to get my act together. I finally went back to college and finished. It took me 17 years to get my undergraduate degree, and I was pretty psyched about that. And then who knew I would become a professional student? I'm now in school again, in graduate school, for my second master's, because, you know, one's never enough, right? And and I'm like, oh my God, you know, I think I got kicked out of school. It was like 4 or 5 times, you know, and I'm like, who knew that I would be like a professional student, you know? But it certainly, but those things, you know, those accomplishments or the things that come in and out of my life are just life stuff, and they're not really about me to some extent, you know. And what really AA has given me, and it talks about it, you know, when it talks about, you know, with the promises, and actually there's promises after every step. I mean, we talk about the promises that come after the ninth step, but there's promises after all the steps. And that sense of peace with myself, I didn't, you know, I had that before, I had that ill at ease, that dis-ease, before I picked up my first drink. And when I picked up that first drink, I felt okay to be me. And I didn't think that anything would replace that feeling, you know, that alcohol gave me. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much more. Not only am I just not constantly, you know, anxious and just, you know, restless type, you know, that, but I actually have, I've had my spirit awakened. You know, I love that idea that, you know, as a result of these steps are, you know, and who knew? You know, I didn't know that I wanted my spirit to be awakened, you know, when I got here. I just wanted, like, you know, you know, to have solid bowel movements. You know, I mean, it was just like, you know, I didn't, you know, those kinds of things that the intangibles that AA has given me, the ability to, like, look people in the eye, the ability to walk down the street and not worry about who is coming in the other direction, to walk into work and go, I wonder what lie I told them, or, you know, why I wasn't here yesterday, you know, like, what did I tell them? Was I sick? Did my car break down? I'm not quite sure, you know, and now when I, you know, now when I forget where my car is, I just plain forgot where my car is, you know, it's not, you know, and, you know, the only husband I sleep with is my own, you know, and you know, all those kinds of you know, things that I never knew that I wanted, you know, but yet they're invaluable to me today. And so if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new in sobriety and you're like, this, you know, doesn't seem like it's a please, you know, please, please keep coming back. You know, there's tons of stories. If you don't relate to my story, you know, keep coming back. I mean, I've heard so many great stories, and it's better than, like, reality TV. You know, there's just amazing, amazing things that happen for people here. And you know, there's an end to trouble, and there's hope. When I came, I have yet to ever feel that sense of despair and desperation since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sure that my life was going from bad to worse, and I knew it, and I knew there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. And each day I woke up thinking that I don't know what horrible thing is going to happen to me today, but I know something bad's going to happen. And I've had some tough times in sobriety, like I said, you know, some horrific losses and those kind of things, but I have never been without hope here. I believe that, you know, like the song says, the sun will come out tomorrow, you know, and I firmly believe, you know, it will be okay in the end, and if it's not okay, then it's not the end yet. So, but it is the end for me, and I thank you all so much for letting me share. Thank you.